Just like backyard barbecues or a day at the pool, the Three Rivers Festival has always been a part of our summer fun. And the festival returns July 12th to the 20th. It kicks off with the annual Three Rivers Festival Parade. Browse art in the park with local artisans. Bring the family to Children's Fest. Stroll through Junk Food Alley. And don't forget about the festival concerts at the Hoosier Lottery stage with live music from nationally renowned acts. You can buy your concert tickets or check out a schedule of events at threeriversfestival.org. Don't miss the best summer experience in Fort Wayne, the Three Rivers Festival.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
All right, it's the Double G Show here after a pretty, would you call this fight historic just because of the stakes involved?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say this is a pretty historic fight for its undisputed heavyweight champion in 25 years. Now, wait a minute, Garrett. You said the last time we were here that the next time was going to be Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson. Now, what is going on?
I know. I thought about it, and then I realized that this was a historic fight, and I kind of had to watch it. Now, if I would have, I should have done a better job, because what happened is we had bought tickets to see Imaginary Friends, the new Ryan Reynolds movie. We have my stepkids are here this weekend. So we have them every other weekend. But so we're like, oh, let's go to the movies. And then I totally forgot that the fight was going to be in the afternoon and not in the evening for me. So I was like, oh, no. And then I was checking in with you to make sure that the main event hadn't started yet. So I literally got home, bought the pay-per-view, and then some rappers started rapping.
I'll be honest, generally didn't know who that was. It was, I mean, at some point, I guess they had to do something with the whole Ring of Fire gimmick. And I guess that was their whole deal, just putting a giant jumbotron across the ring.
It's Rida season in Saudi Arabia.
When is it not at this point?
All right, what are we talking about? We're talking about Tyson Fury and Oleksandr Usyk. The last time that we chatted, you were not 100% convinced that the fight would not get pushed back again. It did not, though my buddy Doohan, and I actually wanted to get your thoughts on this. So originally, the fight got pushed back. Was it because did Fury get cut in sparring or something? Was that the reason?
Someone got hurt. Someone got hurt, and I think that was, I think it may have been Fury. I'd have to double check.
So my buddy Doohan, who people who have been listening to me forever know Doohan, he said, you know, he kind of had his little conspiracy theory. After seeing Fury weigh in, he thought that maybe Fury was a little heavier than necessary and needed a little bit more time to lose the weight. That was his conspiracy theory because of how lean. He's not a lean man, but he came in lighter than usual. And I know some people thought he kind of looked gaunt at the weigh-in, so they were a little worried about him. But I mean, today during the fight, he was pretty fantastic for a good amount of it. So I don't know, that didn't seem to be a problem. But yeah, I found the whole thing, and you were even speculating, we'll see. There's so many politics involved in this. We're not sure that this fight's going to happen until they actually get in the ring, and they got in the ring today.
Yeah, and also, listen, anything can happen in boxing where a fight will get postponed. We just had, not too long ago, on the last Jake Paul fight, Amanda Serrano was going to be the main event, and then we find out, like, 30 minutes before she was supposed to fight, she kind of messed up her eye because of some hair gel, and we just didn't announce it until like 30 minutes before the fight. So that again reaffirmed my belief: nothing is ever assured until we see the two fighters in the actual ring.
Yes. So this fight, when it came to the stakes, like you mentioned, for the Undisputed Champion, the politics of boxing, the ABCs of these promoting companies make it so hard for these types of fights to happen. They're supposed to have a rematch, and we'll get to kind of what happened and how Usyk won the fight. But is the rematch even going to be for the Undisputed title?
That is the how much money we're talking now for the rematch for Usyk, like what, $20-30 million at this point? So basically, and I kind of hinted this on the Discord, the Fight Game Media Discord. But basically, for those of you who don't know how boxing works, or at least at the pro level, there are four sanctioning bodies, the four main sanctioning bodies: WBA, WBO, BC, and IBF. Every sanctioning body at one point has their own set of mandatory challengers, their number one guy that the champion must fight. And when a guy has more than one of those world titles, there's kind of like a informal rotation system that's like, okay, this sanctioning body, they're going to get their mandatory out the way first, and so on and so forth. Now, because we're going to get a rematch, or at least that's what everything's leading up to now, there is kind of a worry right now that, hey, maybe it won't be for the Undisputed Championship. The IBF, who has a mandatory challenger in Filip Hrgović, they are the strictest when it comes to enforcing their mandatories. Then they don't care who their champion is. If the IBF gives you a deadline, fight our mandatory challenger, and if you don't, we'll strip the title. They've done it to Canelo Alvarez. They've done it to Terence Crawford not that long ago. So they got no problem stripping Hrgović of the title. Also depends, you know, maybe if Usyk's team can negotiate with Hrgović, saying, listen, you'll get your shot. Or whoever's going to be champion, you'll get your shot after the rematch. We'll just pay you a step aside money. I mean, we just saw, I mean, WBC. They got a new mandatory challenger now in Agit Kabayel, who was on the undercard today. He's now also next in line to fight Usyk, hypothetically. and then Anthony Joshua. He's number one ranked by the WBO. So there's a good chance by the time we get to October that Oleksandr Usyk might not be the undisputed heavyweight champion. Quote-unquote undisputed, because he's not going to be holding all the four titles, but in everybody's eyes, he is the number one guy, unequivocally the guy in the division.
All right, so this fight begins, and I thought Fury looked a little indecisive. Maybe he looked a little defensive. Like he's a fantastic for a man of his size. He moves around the ring fantastically well, and even more impressive, I think, is he understands where he is inside the ring, which we saw during the knockdown in the ninth round. Like, I think if he doesn't understand how long he is, where the ropes are, he may have hit the canvas and not gotten back up because he was reeling so hard. But I'm so impressed at just the body control, because you look at him and he doesn't look like he's in fantastic shape. He's always been, a little loose around the body, but just his knowledge of self in his size and knowledge of ring, being sort of a ring general. And I thought he kind of overdid it in the beginning. Like, there was this feeling out process where, you know, I was just thinking, like, man, you know, the little guy's kind of taking the fight to him, and he's backing him up in the corner, and Fury's trying to make it look like that's where he wants to be so he could try and do some rope-a-dope stuff. I don't think it really worked. I don't think anybody really bought it. And then just like that, boom, Fury is able to turn it on in the fourth round and really just takes the fight over. Like, what did you think of the beginning stages? Usyk being the smaller man, taking the fight to the bigger man, and then almost like in a snap of fingers, Fury just being like, okay, enough of this stuff. I'm going to take control of this thing.
Usyk being the one taking charge at the start of the fight, it almost kind of felt like it had to be how Usyk was going to win the fight, because he was the smaller guy. And so he can't in a fight where he back when he was at cruiserweight against guys similar to his size, he didn't have to be the one taking the initiative because the other guy would just try to do that and he would just outbox and outjab his opponents to a victory. But this time now at a heavyweight, it's obviously going to be a little bit different. And so what I thought at the beginning, with Usyk taking charge, I thought Fury, like you said, it was a bit of a feeling out process because it didn't quite look like in those first two rounds that Fury really had an idea of his range and what he could do and what the timing of Usyk's punches was going to be. And I thought that, the rope-a-dope stuff, I mean, it didn't clearly work. Clearly, Usyk was not taking the bait, or at the very least, Usyk was able to see through what Fury was kind of trying to do. Because, I mean, with other fighters, I mean, Fury pulled that kind of like that little thing he does in the corner where he got both arms and he's just kind of like shaking around. Like, he, you know, it may have worked with guys like Otto Wallin, but for Usyk, sure, it wasn't going to work. So, you know, I think once Fury kind of found his range, then the game plan of I'm going to fight basically the entire fight off the back foot and let Usyk come to me. And because I have a much longer reach, I can just use the uppercut and try to work the body and land some big hooks on Usyk. And it did work for a while. But, you know, Usyk is such a dynamic fighter, an absolute mastermind of a genius in the ring, that he was able to eventually figure out Usyk and able to find the holes in Fury's defense to be able to take control of the fight.
Then, as Fury kind of took control a little bit, I thought he took a couple of rounds off. Now, that could have been because of fatigue. It could have been because maybe he thought, you know, he was ahead. He could have been, maybe being a little bit too cute with things. And, Usyk is pressing him, and he's making him work. And I thought he gave away a couple of rounds after he had sort of taken control. And, you know, the thing about scoring this fight, and I was actually interested in your feedback on this. When you are scoring a fight, a heavyweight fight, and it's two guys who are generally the same size, I feel like it's much easier to see who is landing the better shots, the cleaner shots. But when you're watching two guys of just severe size difference, when you see Usyk land to the head, it's just much more impressive than Fury punching down and, you know, throwing those body shots, because he was landing tons of body shots, which you had said in the Discord earlier that, you know, if there is one weakness in Usyk's game, it is taking those body shots. And so, like, the oohs and ahs when it came to, you know, what lands higher on the impressive scale. To me, those Usyk shots to the head were more impressive than Fury, like, throwing, you know, hooks to the body. So in some instances, I felt, well, maybe I'm giving Usyk a little bit too much and not scoring enough for Fury. So then I was watching for more things, but then he'd land another big shot to the head and you'd see Fury kind of roll around against the ropes. I found that some of these rounds were hard just because of the dynamic of the size and the little man punching the big man just being more impressive. And you can go back in history of heavyweight fights to where the one that comes to mind is Michael Spinks and Larry Holmes, where both of those fights, they were hard to score because it just, every time Michael Spinks hit Larry Holmes, you were like, oh my gosh, I didn't think he was going to be able to hit him. What's going on here? And it just looked more impressive.
Yeah, indeed. And to your credit, I mean, look, this is stylistically, these guys are very different. Physically, these guys could not look any more different. Usyk is very small, 220. And Fury is this absolute giant of a man who was 40 pounds heavier than Usyk and was coming in much lighter than usual. And so when it comes to scoring that fight, eventually you have to really do break it down to the four elements of scoring a fight: effective, clean punching, ring generalship, defense, and effective aggression. And Usyk was ticking off those boxes more so than Fury, because if you notice, even more so during the middle portion when Fury was winning the fight, you did kind of, at least for me, it felt like Fury, he wasn't so much as taking control of the fight. He was more so doing a better job reacting to Usyk trying to be the one putting forth the aggression. Usyk was the one pushing the action forward, or at least trying to, but it wasn't doing a good job. And so Fury was able to land the cleaner shots. He was able to effectively create better opportunities and sort of, in a sense, take control of the fight by letting the other guy think he's trying to take control of the fight. But eventually it didn't work out, because as you kind of alluded to, he did take off rounds in the middle portion of the fight. And I think it was the seventh round. Mm-hmm. There was the end of the seventh round where Fury was winning for the vast majority of the round. And then he started taking the foot off the gas pedal. The moment he did that, Usyk rocked him a little bit, not enough where Fury was hurt, but you can kind of now sense a bit of a momentum shift. And then Usyk just started dominating the fight from that point onwards, which leads to that incredible ninth round that Usyk had.
Yes. So we get to the ninth round, and for about, I don't know, 2 minutes and 30 seconds or so, I thought it was pretty close. I may have leaned towards Fury. And then all of a sudden, Usyk knocks him off balance. And so, like I said, Fury's a big dude. So in order for him to stop his momentum, it probably takes a lot of effort. And so Usyk continued to press him and knocked him off balance even more. And this is where, you know, if Fury wins this fight, this is kind of like the underrated part of the fight, because he is so off balance and he is being held up essentially by these ropes, but also the knowledge of where he is and where he can lean on and where he can stop himself. And then he gets tagged again, ends up in the corner, and he's about to like sit in the corner. Like he's going down, like as if he's going to sit. Referee, first he waved his hands, and I was like, oh my gosh, is he waving this fight off?
But I thought the same thing too. I thought that he was actually about to stop the fight.
Yes, but no, he just calls the knockdown to stop Usyk from coming forward. And so Fury is able to get up. You hear the count. He's able to answer. And then the bell essentially saves him. And, you know, this is everything, little thing about luck or whatever, the 30 seconds. Had Fury actually come back to win this fight, I think people would be rewatching this round to see, okay, should he have stopped it? What's going on here? You know, is it a save by the bell? And then going into the 10th, I thought Usyk kind of let him off the ropes there a little bit by not pressing him as hard as he could have. Because, you know, Fury is probably 20 seconds from, you know, if there's 20 more seconds in that round, who knows, he would have been able to be stopped. There's only 60 seconds until the next round. So he's got to quickly get his faculty straight and get back in there. And I thought that was an opportune time for Usyk to just press him. But he kind of did, and then he pulled back. But let's go back to the knockdown. Tell me what you thought about the knockdown, and then about Usyk's strategy in the 10th round.
To me, it felt like that was the consequences of Fury kind of letting the foot off the gas pedal. And I don't think Fury, as great as Fury is, I don't think he's as skillful enough of a tactician to be able to immediately think on the fly for a way to sort of get back into the game to avoid getting knocked down. And I think Usyk was, first of all, I was very surprised, not very surprised, but a little surprised that Usyk wasn't trying to go for the body shots pretty much for the entire fight. and instead trying to go headhunting. And it did work, because I think what happened is Fury was so focused on basically trying to box off the back foot that he really wasn't focused so much on defending upstairs. And so because he wasn't doing that, I think it created the opening for Usyk to land those shots to stun Fury. I think ultimately, I didn't have a problem with the referee not stopping the fight. I think Mark Nelson did a good job at sort of letting things kind of go through and then ultimately giving Fury another chance. You say 20 seconds. I think 10 seconds. I think if there were 10 more seconds, I think Usyk would have stopped him. But as for the 10th, I was saying it on our Discord. Usyk did, yes, let Fury off the hook a little bit. But I think it was out of caution. And I think it was because he understands that, Fury may still be wobbly, but he's still a guy 40 pounds heavier than me and much longer and cool and does have power to sort of stop me on a moment's notice. So I think he was trying to approach it a little bit more intelligent in a way where he tried to sort of keep outboxing Fury, because while Fury may have sort of been given a chance to recover, it wasn't so much to the point where Fury could be as effective fighting off the back foot as he did in rounds 3 through 6, because he was still hurt. So I think Usyk's game plan was, okay, let's take the 10th and really dominate Fury, at least boxing-wise, to at least get that round on the scorecards. And then whatever happens in the 11th and 12th round, if I could stop him, that'll great. But if not, then at least Fury is still not fully recovered to the point where he can easily win back the rounds that he lost in the second half of the fight. So I think Usyk was trying to sort of play a little bit more cautiously and trying to go for the long game instead of trying to go for the immediate knockdown. Because how many times have we seen fighters basically at their wit's end, they're hurt, and they just land a miraculous shot to win? I mean, what is one of the most famous moments in boxing history? You know, Meldrick Taylor, Chavez, Julio Cesar Chavez. I mean, I think Usyk was smart enough to sort of recognize that he doesn't want that to potentially be in play. And so he'll just sort of let the foot off the gas pedal just a little bit, but not enough to where Fury can fully recover, but at least keep an ongoing steady pressure on Fury so that he doesn't get back to comfortably boxing like he did in 3 for 6.
So the scorecards, and I'm going to read the scorecards, the split decision, and then go backwards a little bit, because I'm interested in how you scored the last round or the last two rounds. But the scorecards were 115-112 Usyk, which was my score, 114-113 Usyk, which was your score, and a couple of other folks in the Discord who were watching live. And then the one that made it the split decision was 114-113 Fury. Now, how did you score the 12th round? Because on, I'm wondering on the 114-113 Usyk, if, because my thought was, as we get to this 12th round, the fight is so close that both guys probably have to feel like they need to have an impressive 12th round. And not saying that, you know, it may be a little reckless to go for a knockout when you know you have a mandatory rematch coming. But at the same time, the fight was so close that I thought, you know, they should have gone for it a little bit more. But at the same time, they're really tired. You know, it was a fight in which I'm sure both guys were not feeling great going into that 12th round. But at the same time, because, you know, I heard Fury after the fight was like, well, I thought I was winning, and if someone had told me that I needed to knock him down to win the fight, I would have done it, which is I hate that excuse the most.
Yeah.
Because as we've seen in the history of this game, nobody knows what the scorecards are. They're all secret. They're not announcing them. If they announce them, then maybe you have a point. But because they're not telling you, you have to go into that 12th round thinking, I probably need to knock him down to decisively win. And of course, that excuse is always there for him. Was, oh, I just thought I was going to win.
Yeah. Okay. So working a little bit even before that, I scored the 11 for Usyk. And I thought that Usyk would just did a little bit better. And I think Fury was still just on the cusp of fully recovering, but still not quite there. The 12th round was a complete toss-up. You could have scored it for anybody. Mm-hmm. I ultimately gave it to Fury because I thought Fury was just a little bit better as far. I thought his shots were just a tiny bit better looking, a bit cleaner, a bit stronger than Usyk. Fury was all, and you know, there were some sequences where I think Fury was able to avoid trouble pretty well, given the state that he was in. I thought that, you know, he kind of started to not fight off the back foot as much as he previously did, and just started to attack a little bit more in the ring. It, I mean, he's, the opening sequence of that 12th round was, I mean, just Fury basically bear hugging Usyk for the majority of the first 30 seconds. So I think so. I kind of gave that, and not only that, he was basically, when they were clinching, I mean, Fury was landing more shots, and he was landing more to the body. But I think so I kind of gave that 12 to Fury, but that one was like extremely close. I wouldn't have had any issue with it, with anyone scoring it for Usyk. Which, oddly enough, I have all the official scorecards. All three judges actually gave the final round to Fury.
And, okay.
Yeah, and they, and for the 11th, they, two of the three judges scored it for Usyk. One gave it for Fury, and oddly enough, the one that scored the 11 for Fury was actually the one that was not the one, the Fury scorecard.
Got it. That's interesting.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 2 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, you know, when you're, because we're sort of tracking the scores, and Nick Mahmoud, who was in the Discord with us, he had it very early. Like, he had almost every round for Fury early, and I was, and the way that I saw it, I had every round for Usyk until the fourth. Now, I think a lot of people gave Fury the third. And so, you know, just knowing what we were looking at in the Discord, I was like, oh man, I can't imagine what these real scorecards are going to read. I don't think anybody is seeing this exactly the same. So, which again, kind of to my point of Fury, you know, saying, oh, you know, if I thought I needed to knock him out, I would have knocked him out. Whatever. That's just, he's just saying that for, you know, for his own ego, I guess. But does having an automatic rematch on the Fury side work in his favor to where, hey, no matter what happens, this fight is close. If I win, I win. If I don't, I don't. But I have the automatic rematch. Now, if I go out there in the 11th and 12th and Usyk puts me on my ass again, then I just look like I'm, you know, that I'm not anywhere near this guy. And so I wonder if that played into sort of the strategy as he went into those last couple rounds.
I would actually kind of think it would have the opposite effect, because we've seen Fury dropped, and we've seen Fury dropped many times in a fight, and he was able in those fights, he was not able to get out with a loss. He still came out with his record relatively unscathed. You know, and I'm talking about the first Deontay Wilder fight, which ended in a draw.
Mm-hmm.
So I genuinely think that Fury did believe he did do enough in the early going. And listen, I know there were a couple of rounds that were swing rounds. You could kind of make the argument for one the other. I thought personally most of the rounds were somewhat clear cut. You can kind of know who scored. I mean, round one was for Usyk, 3-6 was for Fury, in my opinion, and then 7-10 was all Usyk, including the knockdown. So I do think that Fury kind of did believe that. I don't think the rematch kind of played in his head. I know that was like the immediate thing he went to towards the other fight, aside from the really dumb comments about Ukraine, but don't need to get into that right now. So I think that, you know, Fury was in this, okay, I've been dropped, I've been there, done that. I still believe I won the majority of the rounds, mm-hmm. just because I was landing the better shot and boxing better than my opponent, because that's kind of what happened with the first Deontay Wilder fight. Not for a fact that Fury was dropped a million times in that fight. He did. He outboxed Deontay every single round that he didn't get dropped.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of, who was the announcer? The lead play by play,
Todd Grisham.
Todd Grisham tried to get a couple wrestling references in there. I heard an Undertaker reference in the play-by-play. My buddy Doohan, he had a tweet something like, you know, we have this historic fight. We haven't had an undisputed champion in a while, and Todd Grisham's doing play-by-play. He said that was like
the guy that called ECW on Sci-Fi is the one announcing the next undisputed heavyweight championship fight.
I mean, all the money that they're paying for these fights, they can't pay Jim Lampley to come to these fights.
So the way Lampley now kind of explains about a potential return to announcing. So he has a deal, quote unquote, with an online streaming service, online pay-per-view streaming service, pay-per-view.com. This has got a deal with them. So basically it's like, hey, if someone wants to pay me to announce them, sure, but I want pay-per-view.com's blessing and permission to do it. Otherwise, I'm not doing it, I don't know how much Jim Lampley's going to pay. It can't be that much to where
pay-per-view.com
good on a good deal.
Pay-per-view.com is essentially the online wing of on demand, right?
I think so.
On demand is going bye-bye next year.
Yeah,
so pay-per-view.com is essentially going to be the only thing that they have.
Yeah, if I remember correctly from what Dave Meltzer was saying, they're only gonna stay on, I think, for like either the halfway point of 2025 or the end of 2025. I'm curious sort of what happens with Jim afterwards. I mean, we're now in this weird kind of period where, you know, PBC is kind of off to like a weird start with Amazon Prime. I don't know how much we're gonna see of PBC in 2025. Or, you know, what's going to happen with Top Rank? Because they, you know, their deal with ESPN, that thing's not expiring in the way, way future. It's only got a couple of years left, I believe. So it's still interesting to see that Jim Lampley is technically, like, he's not announcing fights per se. He's just doing stuff for anything?
I haven't heard his voice in forever.
God, I don't
Oh my gosh.
No, I don't think he's Jim, even.
Do you know that Jim is 75 years old?
God. You know what's amazing? I don't even remember, but before pay-per-view.com, Jim Lampley was contracted to do play-by-play for Triller.
Yeah.
For Triller Boxing. That, and the first fight was supposed to be Teofimo Lopez versus George Kambosos before Triller Boxing kind of went up in flames before they even have their first proper boxing show. So Jim never actually did a show for them.
Yeah. I guess he's writing his autobiography, which is kind of interesting. I would buy that. I'm definitely buying that if it whenever it comes out.
I grew up with Jim's voice calling fights on HBO, so I'm gonna get it too.
So the split decision scores, you know, we both scored the way that we scored the fights fit right in there. Is there a Tyson Fury? I haven't seen any of the online discourse, but is there a sentiment of Tyson Fury fans who think that he won this fight?
Honestly, I have not seen anybody make the argument that Tyson Fury won the fight. In fact, some people actually have a problem with the 114-113 scorecard for Usyk, because they don't think that Fury didn't even win six rounds in this fight. This is kind of one of those rare occasions where there is online, there is a almost unanimous consensus. I thought in a very, very close fight, the right man won, which is very rare to see.
So after the fight, they both talked about the rematch. Fury basically said, yes, October. I want to do it. They ask Usyk, and I don't even think it's not even Usyk's call, right? It's Fury's call.
No, I guess technically it's Fury's call. The rematch clause goes both ways. So if Usyk had lost and he wanted a rematch, then the rematch would have happened. But I guess I think
essentially, if Fury says no, I don't want to fight again, Usyk is not going to say no mandatory rematch. No, he already won. So essentially, it is Fury's call. Right. So, I think it's in the best interest of the sport for it to happen again. I think they definitely, this wasn't one of those fights where I'm sure anybody was bummed out about having to pay for it. You know, I don't know about you watching the full 7 hours. I don't know how many people of those were there to do that. But I only saw one fight. And I loved it. I thought it was really good. So I think it is in, you know, the best interest for them to come back. Now coming back, I think I'm not wondering about, you know, what each guy does. I think, you know, if you're wondering about, oh, you know, who's gonna, you know, maybe not be the most responsible, you're probably worried a little bit more about Fury than you are about Usyk, you know, in the months until they do the fight again. It is probably in Fury's best interest to do it sooner than later. He is the older fighter. But, you know, do you sense that anything would change, or would we see a similar fight and, you know, it could go the same way? The only thing that I was thinking of is there were some moments where I wonder if Fury saw that he had hurt Usyk, but because he was fighting this sort of counter style, like you were saying, on his back foot, he did not come forward to maybe do more damage. And I wonder if that would be something that he would change about his game plan, is to follow up a little bit more. But other than that, like, I mean, these guys are both fantastic boxers, and you know, I imagine the rematch will be razor close as well.
Yeah, I think this all the answer to this question kind of all boils down to sort of what Tyson looked like yesterday, because he came in the lightest he's ever been since the Adovalin fight, which was 5 years ago. And now, like, obviously now looking with the fight, the benefit is with the benefit of hindsight, we now kind of have a clear picture as to the why, which is, you know, Fury was going to be moving around, was going to be moving on his back foot. Obviously, you know, the heavier you are, the harder that's going to be, and the more it's going to wear down on you. And I thought that that might not have been the best game plan. And even yesterday, I was saying, I didn't fully agree with Tyson in this weight cut because now, because one of Tyson Fury's strength is that he is such a big guy, but he's so agile and so mobile and such in a fantastic boxer is that he can smother you and still sort of out hit you at the same time. But now when it comes to the rematch, now I'm wondering if Usyk is going to go for that tactic again, maybe come in a little bit heavier this time to try to wear down Usyk because part of the problem with Fury's plan of fighting off the back foot is that it ultimately, while yes, Usyk was out of range in some sequences, there was almost never a moment in the fight where Usyk didn't have room to operate. And I think that's the trap that a lot of fighters kind of sometimes fall into when they're fighting Fury, Usyk, is that when you give Usyk an opportunity, even for just a small moment, to sort of let him operate his game plan, he's almost untouchable because you are now because you're now officially fighting his fight, and there's probably no better fighter in the world right now that can do that better than Alexander Usyk. So I think now for the rematch, I think Fury is going to make this like a real phone booth type of battle. We're just going to keep smothering Usyk, like not let him have a chance to even breathe for most of the fight.
As we move on towards late spring, early summer, we talked about, you know, coming back and chatting after the Tyson and Jake Paul fight, not because it's a fight like today, just because of the craziness and the hype and the overall availability with Netflix being involved. I wanted to kind of change gears. We have a 15-20 minutes left. I wanted to change gears a little bit because there's this discussion around pro wrestling about media and how you should cover pro wrestling, and the content creators have kind of become a larger part of overall media in that space. And I was thinking about from the boxing end. Now, I've been credentialed at Andre Ward's Sakio Bika. That was interesting in that it was a Bay Area fight. It was in Oakland. There wasn't a ton of national media. There were sports writers that I had recognized, but it wasn't like this giant. It was more of a localized kind of Andre. You know, Andre is a great fighter, but he's not like the craziest, most popular fighter out there. I you know, it was kind of a small thing. I didn't sense that there was any nonsense. You know, Andre's a straight shooter. I don't imagine he's not the kind of guy who's going to bring crazies to the event. But I know you've also been media at these boxing events. What is your overall take on the boxing media and where things are right now?
It is kind of an interesting spot right now because, well, as we kind of now, much in the same vein as in pro wrestling, where a lot of media is now gravitating now closer to content creators and less so about traditional media and traditional journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I think that it's now, and I think this is starting, and I don't think this is just a pro wrestling and a boxing thing. I think this is just entire media thing where people now are less so pulled in with the news, but more so the reaction and the opinions of these people who cover these news and these sports and everything in between. And I, you know, and during my time covering boxing, I can't tell you how many times where I sat in a room full of, or in an area full of media, and like half of them, you know, they're not actual journalists. They're just guys with YouTube channels who just got in, and they're just, you know, they either like they know the fighter, or like they have like a real bias towards like a certain fighter and to try to and like try to pull in favorites and get in and everything. It, you know, there's only like a handful of like real top-notch actual quality journalists out there in boxing. I think part of the problem is that covering boxing is really not a high paying job. It's there's like a handful of people in the world right now that can cover boxing on a full-time basis and actually just live off of the hell, Jake Donovan, who is maybe the best boxing journalist in the world right now. I mean, I don't know if his work at Ring Magazine is his full-time job now, but for a long time, you know, covering boxing, that wasn't even his, that was even his full-time job. He was doing this alongside doing other journalist work. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the space has kind of now allowed himself with like these bombastic people who just try to be able to make money out of creating content that isn't necessarily traditional media that you and I would think would try to consume. It's more so opinions. It's more so hot takes. It's more so like trying to be the Stephen A. Of the sport and kind of putting my own spin about it. And, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, guys with YouTube channels who I'm not going to name, but have very, very low opinions of, just because, you know, they try to represent themselves as like being part of the media and being journalists when all they're doing is like almost the complete opposite of what a journalist should be. But to the greater point, I think boxing is kind of trending to a weird little direction because of the fact, obviously, now we have all these fights taking place in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing like all these journalists, like, for lack of a better phrase, kind of like kissing up to the Saudis, you know, constantly, you know, pulling out the proverbial red carpet and you know, referring to him as His Excellency all the time. And it's a little bit weird because you're not, you know, as a journalist, you know, that's not really the kind of conduct you should try.
It's such an interesting thing because I know, like, you'll hear it in NBA conversation where a reporter will call, instead, let's say Steve Kerr, say you're interviewing Steve Kerr post game, they just lost, and you'll hear reporters call him coach. And that is a little weird because his name is Steve Kerr. He's not your coach. like it is a way to kind of maybe try and cut the tension a little bit. You know, if you're maybe the Warriors lost, or, you know, maybe you have a question that's going to be a little harder hitting. And so you use the term coach. And that
Deion Sanders had a similar thing because he refused to acknowledge a reporter who didn't refer to him as Coach Sanders or Coach Prime.
Yeah. So that whole thing is a song and dance. And, you know, the Warriors, they have a guy who, if a goofball somehow got a press credential and asked a goofy question, they have a senior vice president of communications named Raymond Ritter, who would probably physically remove that person himself from, you know, from the press conference. And you don't see that as much in some of these other sports, like, you know, covering a UFC event. I was talking to Dave Meltzer the other day. The UFC event, somebody got a question in about getting branded by the name of Donald Cerrone on them. Or there was another one about I forget the guy's name, the fighter, he threw his cup into the crowd, and somebody caught the cup.
It was like,
how can I get this signed? Dana, can you help me get this signed? Kind of stuff is goofy. And if there was somebody who really wanted to keep that press conference kind of in line and serious, they would boot them out. But at the same time, Dana White is talking about this power slap and how the online minutes of viewership is actually important, and people need to pay attention to this because this thing is going crazy. And if you actually had real media there, I'm not saying that they didn't. UFC has real media, but Dana White wants to be able to spew that kind of nonsense to make it look as if this power slap thing is on anybody's radar, and it's not. And, you know, not that many people are going to call him out on that nonsense. So, you know, also at the same time, what does the sport want out of the coverage? Does the sport want like real coverage, or does it want essentially PR? You know, probably wants PR to an extent, but I just find that kind of thing very interesting. And it leaned over into WWE's press conference the other day, where the young reporter asked a real question and was like essentially shamed online and by WWE's own PR staff at the same time. So I find this whole thing super interesting. And, you know, that there is a process to get a to get a press credential for WWE. It's really hard. Like, it's not, you know, I got one, and I'm sure it's because I was able to put the Wrestling Observer on there. I wasn't able to go, but, you know, imagine being a budding journalist, you know, imagine being Carlos Toro Media and you're trying to work with WWE to get a press credential. And okay, what is your website? How many views? You know, what's your YouTube channel? How many followers? If you're not like this heavy hitting, you know, Twitter guy, like, so they're studying all of these things as well. Like, to what's their benefit to having you cover when it comes to providing them coverage? Like, this is, you know, this is a part of all of that.
Yeah. And I echo, you know, Dave's sentiment when he was talking not too long ago. You know, when you're there in these press conferences, you're there as media, it's not your job to throw these softball questions and essentially do the PR work for them. You're there to ask tough questions, and you're not necessarily tough questions, but you're there to ask good questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always that time and place for, you know, tough questions, hard-hitting journalism and all that. Obviously, press conference might not always be the place to do it, but you're not.
Yeah. And to your point, on the other side, if you're only there to ask provocative questions so that you can become the provocative question asker, that is on the other end. You don't want that. You don't, that's in it for the wrong reasons as well, but go ahead.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've said it in a couple of press conferences, especially during COVID, where I'm not going to name the reporter, but the story, but basically what happened was, this is a funny little story. Basically, it was for Jermall Charlo, and he and this reporter basically asked about, I think, you know, that Charlo was recently vacationing in Mexico. I think that was what happened. And basically was trying to goad Charlo into trying to get him to call out Canelo. And Charlo just immediately stopped the reporter right there. Like, don't do that. I know what you're doing. No, I'm not. We're not going to play that game. And so it's now, there's certain aspects where even, you know, asking these provocative questions, it's like you're also doing the exact opposite effect for trying to be good media, which is now you're just further incentivizing these companies to sort of not bring in any media that would bring in any type of quote unquote what they would deem controversial question or question they don't want necessarily asked in a press event like that. So ultimately, I think part of the problem is there's no media literacy and journalistic ethics is something that's like it's being taught less and less, because now the way people consume media is through these personalities, and they try to mimic what works for them. Because in being provocative and giving hot takes, that's what's getting the views, that's what's getting the clicks. Not asking about like such and so incident or like such and so controversy in a way to try to cover it like a news story. That's not gravitating people towards the content and to the product. So I think that's part of the problem, is that journalism is not being taught enough where these people can cover these events how they should.
Yeah. Did you see the Netflix Jake Paul and Mike Tyson press conference? There was a kid. He looked like he was, I don't know, like 13 years old or whatever. And he asked Jake Paul and Mike Tyson who had the bigger body count. And Mike Tyson just kept saying, where's this kid's mom? Like, what is what's going on here? And to that point, though, is that is the clip that goes viral on Twitter. Not even for better or for worse, because it entertained people. But at the same time, if you're trying to show that this event and that they're actually making it a real fight and not an exhibition, if you're actually showing that it's a real sporting event, those are the questions that you need to sort of weed out. Like,
and on the opposite end, there was in that press conference, there was another reporter who I thought asked a very valid question, where basically, to paraphrase, he asked a question to Jake. Jake, you keep saying you want to be a legitimate boxer and you want to be a title holder. When are you actually going to make that process and not doing these gimmick fights? Mm-hmm. And Jake turned it around and said, are you saying that Mike Tyson is a gimmick? Now he's basically trying to turn Mike Tyson on the reporter. And basically, the reporter was like, I'm not trying to call Mike Tyson a gimmick. He's 53 years old. So, to me, I think that's a very valid question. Yeah. You know, Jake, you keep proclaiming you want to be a legitimate boxer. Fighting a 53-year-old Mike Tyson is not being a legitimate boxer.
Yeah, it's an absolute valid question. And all Jake has to say to be honest with the media or with that question is he gets paid way more money for these gimmick fights than he would if he was facing the number 17 contender in the weight class and kind of trying to go up in the rankings. There, the risk of getting beat by the number 17 contender to basically kill off any value that he has to the media is not worth, the reward of what he can do and what he's doing now. You know, the thing about it is, if this freak fight stuff stopped working, then he would have to sort of figure out what he's going to do. I don't imagine, you know, he may try and get like a fight against a top guy just to then know that he's going to get beat and that will be his last payday. But there's no reason for him to actually do this for real, because part of the problem with boxing today is when you have these really great fights, you don't have the marketing arms behind these fighters to actually tell us why these guys are great. And I know, you know, people talk about, you know, the UFC being like this, you know, this monopoly on the MMA game. I'm not defending them in any way, because they don't pay their fighters nearly enough. But you actually do have a marketing machine and an advertising machine behind the people that you feel are actually relevant and could be superstars. You are putting dollars behind those people to show your audience that these guys are real. And nobody's doing that for boxers except for boxers. And unless you are, unless you have a great team behind you, what is that machine like? We talked about last week or last time, David Benavidez and Canelo. Well, part of the reason why Canelo is probably not that keen on that fight is because Benavidez is real, but he doesn't have a real name to anybody outside of the boxing world. And so, you know, there's this ecosystem problem that boxing, you know, currently has, and, you know, without HBO being a partner, without, you know, any broadcast television being a partner, it's really hard for these guys to advertise themselves or to market themselves to create a name. And thus we have freak fights for guys who have created that name elsewhere and can utilize that whatever fame is left in a boxing ring.
I mean, why do you think Nate Diaz and Jorge Masvidal are doing boxing fights? It's because there is money in there, but they have the name recognition because of their time in UFC.
So this is why UFC usually will get a cut from this stuff, is because they're like, look, we are the ones who actually spent the dollars to help market you guys. You guys can't then go somewhere else and not give us a cut. Though I don't think the UFC is involved in this thing at all.
No, I don't. I'm pretty sure they're not. But yeah, ultimately, I think that and it goes back to my earlier point when they don't, when you don't have that marketing machine behind you, what do you fall on? You observe what has been getting click and what has been getting followers. And it's these, you know, these fake personalities with the hot takes and being controversial on purpose. And some of these fighters, they fall into that trap of trying to do that. And instead, they just end up just being, you know, these phony people on Twitter where they're just not doing, where the attention needs to be even on their actual boxing career, but more so just being names out there. Then the boxing, in a sense, kind of takes a backseat to it.
Yeah, and then you go overboard with that stuff, and what happens with Ryan Garcia could happen as well. And we've seen that happen just in celebrity in general. All right, is there what is kind of on your radar for the next couple months here?
Okay, so we have the Jake Paul Mike Tyson fight. Don't really care about that fight, but the co-main event, Amanda Serrano versus Katie Taylor, two great fight right there. We got more info on the undercard. H2O Sill versus Floyd Schofield, which are two very good lightweight prospects. That is a genuinely great fight because you have two unbeaten prospects, and in the United States, you don't really get to see those types of fights all too often. I'm not really super paying much attention to this other fight on the undercard, but it's just another freak fight. Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. versus Darren Till, of all people, and it's weird. I actually don't have any faith in Chavez winning that fight.
Darren Till's not even a giant MMA name. He's just, I guess he's a recognizable name if he followed MMA.
Yeah, I you know, when was the last time we've seen Darren Till fight in the UFC in any meaningful fight? It's been years. So anyway, that's part of the Jake Paul fight. You know, next week, Josh Taylor versus Jack Catterall, very interesting fight, the rematch from their undisputed 140 pound fight from a couple of years ago, where everyone thought Jack Catterall was robbed, rightfully so, in my opinion. So they'll having a rematch at 140. The next big Saudi Arabia card is going to be on June 1st. Which is headlined by Deontay Wilder versus Zhilei Zhang as part of that legally distinct Survivor Series thing that Eddie Hearn and Frank Warren are doing. Undercard is actually really solid. Philip Hergovich versus Daniel Dubois, two heavyweight contenders on the cusp of, you know, trying to move up to become the first guy up in challenging the winner of Fury Usyk 2. Raymond Ford, who just had one of the best performances in recent memory in winning his featherweight title. Trying to think of what else. I mean, as far as giant fights, I mean, also, you know, Gervonta Davis and Frank Martin on June 15th. And you mentioned David Benavidez. He's the co-main on that one. That's the next PBC on Prime Video show. So it's quite a lot of fights coming up and almost on a weekly basis now.
Are you going to follow Olympic boxing come August?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. The Olympic boxing, I know, obviously has had a lot of issues with between the IOC and boxing's global amateur governing body, with the whole corruption scandal and the risk of boxing not even being in the Olympics because of all the issues that's going. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting names already out coming into the Olympics. A couple of names that quite frankly I thought should have been in for the U.S. Olympic team. They got cut out. If you thought pro boxing politics is bad, amateur boxing politics is just as bad. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, Olympics are a real good way of finding out who's going to be the next guy. And some of these guys, even when they don't medal, they get signed and they get a giant push into the into the pros. I mean, Usyk, Olympic champion, look what he got a massive push very early on in his career.
And I guess if you subscribe to Peacock, you're probably going to be able to watch just about anything and everything you want. So that might be the way to watch all the boxing. Because when they do the normal, you know, the broadcast network stuff, the boxing, if the United States is not involved in a lot of the big fights, you don't even see it. So Peacock is going to be the way to go, I think. All right. So thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. I like the fact that we've done a couple of shows bringing boxing back to Fight Game Media. And we'll do as much as we can. So, Carlos, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Carlos Toro Media. I've been a little bit more active because I mean, a lot of good fights that has been really capturing my, my attention, as of late. I mean, the Naoya Inoue fight, recently.
Did you wake up at like 2 o'clock in the morning or whenever that one was on?
So that was my original plan. I ended up actually, so it's funny. I woke up and I had the first fight kind of like in my head, in bed on my phone with my headphones on. And then I just immediately went back to sleep. And I got back up like right before Inoue stepped into the ring. So I was able to catch that. And what I ultimately did is I kind of watched the card in reverse, where I spent the rest of the morning watching like from the co-main to the second fight to the fight before that, which I thought it was a really, really good card from Japan. If you guys are fans of Japanese boxing, I actually would recommend this. I think the full show is still on ESPN Plus, so it's definitely was a really nice four. I think it was like a 3.5 hour show with coming in with Naoya Inoue with another like unbelievable performance against Luis Neri.
He actually went down in that fight, didn't he?
Yeah, very first round. He caught a real strong left hand from Luis Neri, went down, and then just immediately went to work and dominated the rest of the fight. Funny enough, Naoya's brother Takuma was on the undercard, and his fight almost went exactly how Naoya's fight went, where Takuma was dropped also in the first round, and Takuma ended up winning the fight.
that's funny.
Yeah, only difference is Takuma's fight went to the scorecards. It didn't end with a TKO win.
Is he a prospect as well?
No, he's a world champion. He's the WBA bantamweight champion. He's holding one of the belts that Naoya held when he moved up to his current weight class at super bantamweight. Okay. Yeah, so when Naoya was undisputed champ at bantamweight, he went to super bantamweight, dropped all four of his belts, and Takuma ended up winning one of them.
Wow, that is what a talented family they have. All right, so yeah, that'll be it from here. Carlos and I will be back whenever the next fight is, what we think is in July, but who knows, maybe we'll be inspired to come back before that. So for Carlos Toro, I am Double G. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.